This is Ken Lubin, the host and founder of the Executive Athletes Podcast, and welcome to this week's episode. I want to thank everyone that's been listening, and thank you for the comments and feedback. They're awesome and an incredible help in this journey to making this podcast better and better each episode. Once again, like always, this is unscripted and unedited, as I believe it's the best way to get to really know the guests. This week's guests are working on an amazing mission that I believe is truly remarkable. And as the dad of two amazing daughters, this is a movement that needs to continue and grow. So this intro may take a little bit longer than most, but it is a super important piece of the podcast. So we'll jump into it. Actually, in about 2 days, 3 days in April of 2019, probably when this is posted, it'll be May, they'll be doing the hike. But Carolyn Gleick and Rob Lee will climb Mount Everest as a climb for equality, to highlight the role that men and people of all genders can play in supporting women's leadership in the mountains and beyond. Despite gains for women in other areas of society, only 10% of climbers on 8,000-meter peaks are women. As of June 2017, only 536 women have climbed Mount Everest. It's not enough to have women showing up. We need more women at the top. The Climb for Equality is a social awareness campaign where Rob and Caroline will aim to get 100 mountaineers of all genders to do a social media post about how they will support women's leadership and combat bias. The campaign will provide a tool of kits or a toolkit of ways to interrupt bias. 10% of the funds will go towards organizations that support women's leadership. So I'll jump into the bio of Caroline and then I'll jump into Rob. So Carolyn Gleick, it's been her lifelong dream to ski in the Himalayas. She never thought she would be drawn to Everest until she was on the drive to Choi Yo in September 2018 and saw Everest for the first time. Her first thought was, I want to ski that. Carolyn plans to ski from 7,500 meters down the North Ridge in North Col. It will be a highlight in her skiing career after skiing in big mountain ranges all over the world, including Cordillera Blanca, French and Swiss Alps, Canadian Rockies, and others. As a professional ski mountaineer and environmental activist, Caroline has seen gender inequality among the world's tallest peaks and in the halls of Congress. With strong support from her partner, Rob, they realize that advocating for gender equality isn't only a woman's job, and through this project, aim to bring strong male allies and people of all genders into the conversation. Rob's bio, he's a world champion half Ironman. Rob is no stranger to physically exhausting, challenging, and long days. The list of triathlons Rob has completed in is exhaustive, and his love for the sport has given him a new objective, the ultimate world triathlon. And Everest is going to be the first part of this, and he's going to continue to go on from there. But the ultimate world triathlon includes swimming the English Channel and cycling across America after Everest, all within a six-month period. More than the physical challenge, Rob will also raise awareness for gender inequality in the mountains and the boardroom based on the He for She initiative by the UN. Rob's mountaineering career includes climbs of mountains around the world, including Aconcagua, Denali, and most recently in the Himalayas. He is also planning on doing what is called the Ultimate World Triathlon, which I just mentioned before. But again, it's climbing Everest, swimming the English Channel, and riding his bike across America. Welcome to the show, Rob and Caroline. It's great to have you on, and the initiative you're doing is absolutely amazing.
Thanks for having us. We're excited to be here.
Thanks, Ken.
So how did this all come about? You know, I watched a little bit about the videos, got a little bit of background. Rob, you know, we had chatted before, but talk to us how this Climb for Equality started and, you know, what spurred you guys on it.
Yeah, I think it really came about pretty organically. I come from a triathlete background, but I also grew up in the mountains here in Park City, and I've always with mountain climbing. And so I've climbed Aconcagua and Denali, and Everest has always kind of been on my radar. But I was kind of more focused on triathlon until I had a couple of injuries, like most triathletes have, kind of forced me to look at some other things. And I also met Caroline, who obviously is much more focused on skiing and mountaineering. And so what happened was, a couple of years ago, I had ankle surgery, and I was sitting in the doctor's office and they told me, hey, you know, medically speaking, you shouldn't really be running anymore. And so I immediately thought, hey, I need a new goal. Come from a swimming background. So I thought English Channel, I'm going to do the English Channel right there. And then at the doctor's office, I decided that was going to be my goal. I probably should have done a little more research before I looked at her before I decided that. But as I looked into it, I realized how difficult it was really going to be. But I also realized that they call it the Everest of swimming, and Everest has been on my mind. So I kind of thought, gosh, I wonder if anybody's ever done both Everest and the English Channel. And it turns out there are a couple people. I think it's about 8 people have done them, but it's always been spaced out by a couple of years at least. And so I thought, well, maybe I could try to do it in the same year. And then I thought, gosh, but I'm a triathlete. I have to have a bike component to this whole thing. And I've always wanted to ride across America. So wham, bam, there we go. We got the ultimate world triathlon was born.
Wow, that's amazing. And Caroline, tell us a little bit about your background. Is it mostly skiing? What other sports were you in?
Yeah, I ran my first ultra marathon last summer. And then the year before that, I ran 1,000 miles in the year.
Nice.
I've done some bike racing as well, but my call has always been to the high mountains. And when I met Rob, I was a year or two into a 5-year long project to ski all the lines in a guidebook called the Shooting Gallery. And there's 90 steep ski descents in my home mountain range in the Wasatch here in Utah. So Rob helped me a ton on that project. And I like to think that I inspired him a little bit for his bigger project. And we both really inspire each other and push each other in the mountains and in our sports. And I think it's like kind of our goals are from that partnership where we're just always inspiring and pushing one another.
That is amazing. And what was your background in skiing? A lot of people, is it from ski racing? Is it just big mountain skiing? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I grew up in Minnesota and I moved to Utah when I was 15. I never skied competitively, although I always wanted to be a ski racer. But I kind of grew up in the 90s, which was like the golden era of ski mountaineering. So I was always obsessed with trying to take my skis up to mountains where there's no chairlifts or helicopter access, where you have to climb up the mountains to ski down. So I became really focused on that. And you know, it's been like a 15-year long process for me since I graduated from high school of slowly building my career and taking a lot of different avalanche and other mountain safety rescue courses. So I feel I can be really competent and self-sufficient in the mountains. So yeah, it wasn't like, it wasn't something I grew up doing competitively. And I think in some ways that was good because it gave me a strong hunger and desire to build my career as an adult.
Right. No, I know. I know a lot of kids, you know, once they stop ski racing, that's the end of it. Or yeah. They start ski racing later and then it's just, you know, it starts going out of control as well. So it's I love what you're doing there though. The whole big mountain thing is huge. And I'm in the East, not unlike you guys out West with, you know, bigger, taller mountains, but the whole backcountry scene is just huge now. It's, you know, people aren't even really going into, you know, well, they still are skiing ski areas, but the whole backcountry scene is big, but there's more of an issue with avalanches. And I'm sure you're seeing the same thing, that people are less experienced going into avalanche zones.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely like a lifelong process of learning and being, you know, humble. And I lost my half brother to an avalanche and I lost my best friend to an avalanche. So it's also not just beginners who have problems with that. It's also really experienced people who still get into trouble. And it's an unfortunate reality of the sport. But yeah, it's just one of those things where we're constantly learning and evaluating. And I guess that's what I like about it, is that there's always a new challenge and there's always something new to learn. It's sort of like with Rob with triathlon. Like, triathlon has so many different dimensions. It's really good if you sort of have a little bit of ADD, because it's like ski mountaineering too. There's just, you have to train the fitness and the technical aspects and the avalanche rescue. And there's just so many different components that I really enjoy the challenge of how it always keeps me on my toes.
No, that's amazing. What about, you know, and how did this whole Climb for Quality piece come about? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think, again, kind of like the triathlon, it kind of came about pretty organically. One of the reasons is just when we started talking about Everest, and I would bring it up to people that I know. If they knew Caroline, maybe things were a little bit different. But if I mentioned that I was going to Everest, and then I would say, oh, Caroline's coming too, and they'd always be surprised that she was going. And then the next question was always, oh, is she just going to base camp or something like that? And it's it just, you know, it's been something that I've seen in the 4+ years that we've been dating. And that is, people think that I'm guiding her, or that maybe I kind of have more of a right to be in the mountains and doing some of these kind of extreme things than she does. And the reality is, particularly with the backcountry skiing, when I met Caroline, I was pretty brand new to the sport, and most of the time she was basically guiding me. But people would come up to me expecting that I was kind of like leading the tour and that kind of thing. And so when we talked about Everest and people didn't really expect her to go to the top, it was just a natural thing to talk about these implicit bias that people don't really realize what they're saying. And I think most people don't mean to have these gender bias in them. It's just having the conversation so that they can kind of realize what they're saying is what's important to talk about with this with the triathlon.
Right. And raising that awareness is super cool as well, right? Like I said earlier, I've got two young daughters, and it's amazing to see, you know, I think that underlying bias. What I've noticed is it's less and less, in the East, with, you know, we're probably a little bit more liberal toward in the Boston area, but my kids, they both ski race, and the funny thing is there's more females racing than there are males racing now. And it's the coolest thing to see. And you're seeing the guys chase the girls now at this point, you know, in terms of performance. There's almost a flop that's changing. And I know that's a lot, you know, in soccer and a lot of the sports, and, you know, not, I'm just using sports as an example, but a lot of other things, which is great to see.
Right. But what you see that happens a lot of times with women in sports is once they get to be like middle school, or especially like in their 20s and 30s, a lot of women drop out of sports.
Yeah, you're right.
Later in life, when you really see these bigger discrepancies in participation. And then, I mean, another thing with sports is just like the coverage of, I mean, in ski racing, it's really cool because we have superstars like Lindsey Vonn and Michaela Schifrin, and we have some real heavy hitters in on the female side in the U.S. But for female sports overall, only 4% of media coverage is for women's sports.
No, and that's so,
It's really a bummer, because I don't think it's like it limits, like I'd love to see more coverage of women's sports so that little girls can stick with sports and see that it's a viable career as they get older.
No, it should be. And I was very fortunate to go to a speech down on Nantucket called the Nantucket Project, where Hope Solo was. And she was suing U.S. soccer. And, you know, I think the case is still going on, you know, for that equality, and that the women are the only ones going to the finals and winning. And, you know, it was 10% of what the guys were making who couldn't even make the playoffs. It was crazy.
Yeah, it's also crazy. Like the Tour de France, they still don't have a women's equivalent of that race for biking. And it's just that when you look at so many of these sports at the highest level, like you think about how much time people spend watching the NFL, and there is no women's equivalent to that. And so, yeah, it's just something that we are both really passionate about, speaking about gender equality. And it's like also really uncomfortable to talk about. Like it's not an easy conversation to have. However, with the attention that we'll be getting and the eyeballs on our climb, we really wanted to use that as an opportunity to lead this uncomfortable conversation and to segue into something that we're both really passionate about.
No, and let's do segue into that, you know, in talking about the climb itself and what you're doing to train. And you said you're doing a quick ascent. Tell us a little bit about that and the training for that, so you can go over there and bang this out.
Yeah, so we're going with Alpenglow Expeditions. They're out of Tahoe. Adrian Ballinger is the owner of the company and the lead guide, and he's going to be there with us, along with a couple of other clients and guides. And so we're doing this rapid ascent. So we're going to try to climb the mountain in about 5 weeks. We'll be gone from the U.S. Most expeditions are going to be more in the 6 to 8 week range. And the way that we're able to accomplish that is by acclimatizing beforehand. So here at home, we've got a tent over our bed. It's called a hypoxico tent, and there's a machine, or we've actually got two machines pumping air in that's got a less percentage of oxygen in it than we've got. So even though in Park City here we're about 6,500 to 7,000 feet, right now we're sleeping at over 17,000 feet on a nightly basis. And I can tell you, it's not the funnest thing. We wake up all the time, get pretty horrible sleep. But the idea is to acclimatize here so that when we get there, we can kind of go to the mountain and get right to business rather than start to acclimatize there. A lot of the reasons that people don't summit is because they get sick, and there's a lot of reasons you get sick, but just being around folks there at base camp, I think you know, germs get spread pretty easily. People have gastrointestinal problems, that kind of thing. So we're trying to limit some of that exposure to those problems so that when we get there, we're ready to go, we're healthy, and then we can start climbing the mountain.
And what have you been doing for training for, you know, for these events?
Well, I mean, a lot of people have been asking us that, and our training, we both have a really high baseline level of fitness, and we climbed and skied Choyu, the sixth highest peak in the world, in September. So that was a really good dry run to like see how we do at altitude. And so really we've just been working on maintaining our fitness and staying healthy and staying strong. And the normal stuff we do throughout the winter, like long days, backcountry skiing, those set us up really well for success on the high mountain. So just like having that base and trusting in that. And like, we haven't been going too crazy on a training program because we both just have had, you know, a lot of years of big endurance events under our belts.
Well, I'll jump in here because Caroline's obviously not going to say. The other reason that she is not training quite as heavily is because about 6 weeks ago, we actually made our final Everest payment there, which was probably scarier than actually going to climb Everest. And the next day, she was working with a new sponsor on a shoot, and she had a crash skiing and she blew out her ACL. So to have that going into Everest was a big time scary thing, but we got her in to see a number of doctors, and basically we've been taking it day by day, but all the doctors and Caroline agree that she's good to go for Everest. She's going to wear a brace, not going to have an ACL, hopefully summit without an ACL, and then she has surgery within the week that we get back to have that repaired.
You have another ACL anyways. You only need one.
Yeah.
So her training has been more,
it's been different.
PT than anything else. My training, again, you know, my baseline is there. And so I've just been, I've got this, all these other events. So a lot of my training has been swimming and just doing trainer bike rides. We can also set that Hypoxico machine up and have a mask on and do rides at, you know, 18, 19,000 feet just to get those red blood cells. So it's mostly been kind of keeping the fitness there, but also going into this rested and ready to go.
Right, right. What's it feel like to, you know, to sleep at altitude like that in the hypoxic tent, or to ride with the mask on? What's the feeling that you feel like in your body? Do you notice it in your head? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I want to preface this by saying that the manufacturer only recommends people sleeping at up to 9,000 feet. And that is like a sleeping altitude if you want to gain for performance. Like if you want to excel and build red blood cells and do really, you know, perform better, that's what they recommend. So they don't recommend going to 17,000 feet. So like once we got over 13,000 feet, it definitely becomes more of a challenge. And you have poor sleep quality. You wake up a lot. It's hard to sleep. Sometimes you feel really hot and sweaty, and then other times you'll have a slight headache or a stomach ache. It's pretty similar to how it feels sleeping at real altitude, except that you get to come out of the tent during the day and get to experience more of an oxygen-rich environment, which will change once we get there. We won't be able to come out of the tent and recover during the day, but it's been really hard for me.
It's a lot of time in that tent, and it's not comfortable at all. It's nothing that you would choose to do unless, you know, you've got a goal like this and it's just kind of part of the process. I tend to like the bike a little bit more, and I think I haven't done a ton of rides with it, but I tend to think that is going to help me even more because you're actually like walking, or, you know, you're getting exercise while having less oxygen, which is what, you know, the climbing Everest in these big mountains is all about. It's really pretty slow walking generally most of the time, and it's just kind of labored breathing because there's not a lot of oxygen.
Right, right. Do you guys follow any nutrition, you know, any nutrition programs, anything special, or just pretty much eat, you know, eat healthy, normal food?
Yeah, so I ski for Cliff Bar, and their nutritionist wrote me a plan for Everest of like how much to eat on certain days with carrying different kinds of loads at different altitudes. So I have a good program sort of outlined for when I'm on the mountain that I'm going to try to stick to better, because it can be really hard to eat, especially on summit day with the oxygen mask. So we have a nutrition plan for on the mountain, but in terms of our general nutrition leading up to it, we're just kind of more like hands-off flexitarian style, where we eat when we're hungry, we try to eat real food, not too much, not too little, but just to listen to our body's cues.
I think that's the best way to train and race anyways.
Yeah, I think the general idea is to try to limit the processed foods as much as possible. That's not to say that we don't eat processed foods. We do, but as higher on the food chain as you can eat something, that's better. We also recently just had a sweat test done, which is kind of an interesting deal, to see how much salt you actually sweat out. And I did that with Precision Hydration out of the UK. And they've got some really nice products that have different amounts of salt in it. And we realized that when I sweat, my sweat has 3 times the amount of salt that Caroline's does. So our hydration should be adjusted accordingly when we're exercising here or on Everest. So I'm going to take a lot of products to make sure that my salt intake is up to par when I'm there.
Yeah, that was probably the most interesting thing we did, because when we were on this other mountain in September on Choyu, Rob got really bad cramps in his legs, and we thought he almost had a blood clot at one point because he had this really weird pain. And I think now we realize it was probably from an electrolyte deficiency. So,
or salt deficiency.
Yeah.
Sodium.
Yeah. So that was really, really interesting and helpful.
That's eye-opening. I have someone I've done some races with, and he did Race Across America, and his second time, he didn't have a salt test done the first time, then he had a second one done, and it was like exponential how much he would sweat out. So the next time he did it, he was super focused on it and had a way more successful ride across America versus not. I think it's those little nuances that, men, female, or, different body types process or have a different need for salt and electrolytes than others do, right? And I think that's what keeps your system balanced.
Absolutely, yeah. It's something that I wouldn't necessarily think about, but now that I have had the test done, I can go into it with just that little bit of knowledge, and I think it can make a huge difference. I only had cramps for like 2 days on Choyu, but when I had them, I was nervous that I wasn't going to be able to continue up. I mean, it doesn't matter what your fitness is if your muscles just aren't working, and I think it was maybe a sodium deficiency.
Right. Interesting stuff. So you're sleeping at the altitude, you're paying attention to your food, your intake, mentally, psychologically, how are you preparing for this?
Well, I did some yoga this morning. And I mean, I tend to get really bad trip anxiety, like before I go on a trip. And once I get on the plane, I'm usually really chill and I can just relax at that point. But right now I'm pretty stressed out. And I guess it's just really trying to use those meditation techniques and not to worry about the things you can't control and not to worry about the surgery I have right when I get home or how hard it's going to be on Summit Day, but just try to get to like keep putting one foot in front of the other and getting the bags packed. And so we can get out of here on Saturday, like just not trying to spiral, but just trying to do one thing at a time and stay focused.
Right. That's amazing.
And what about you, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I have as much trip anxiety, and people keep asking if I'm just, totally jazzed to go, and I am absolutely. Everest is one of those things that, like I said, has always been on my radar, and the fact that I'm actually leaving for Everest in a couple of days is really surreal. But it's such a slow process from now. Like, I'm mostly packed, and I'm just going to finish that. But we've got so much travel, and then driving, and then even just acclimatizing, going a little higher on the mountain before the real action starts. So it's kind of this delayed thing that's happening, and I'm excited to get there and kind of be in the action, but we still have a lot of travel and everything to get there. So it's just one step at a time, and that means when we're on the mountain, one step at a time. And same thing here, just taking care of one thing after another. I still am working full time. I sell real estate here in Park City, so I've got to balance that in there as well.
Perfect. And so, Rob, tell us a little bit about continuing the expedition to swim in the English Channel and riding your bike across America. So step one is climbing Everest. Tell us about step two and three.
Yeah, so we should get back at the end of May from Everest, and hopefully we have some success there. Then I've got about a month here to really get my swimming fitness ready to go. I feel like I'm in pretty good swimming shape right now, but obviously not swimming for over a month will not be great for my English Channel chances. But the biggest thing for the English Channel is that it's a non-wetsuit swim. So the water should be about 58, 59, 60 degrees. And I'll be in that water most likely, 12 to 14 hours. And so the whole thing is keeping your body warm enough. And so this winter I've been trying to do what I can to basically acclimatize. That means everything from cold showers to I had a ice tub in my backyard that I would go sit in for, you know, 10 to 15 minutes. And just, I'm trying to put on this extra layer of what's called brown fat. I don't know if you're familiar with Wim Hof and some of his teachings, but basically when you're born, you have this extra protective layer. And because we're kind of creatures of comfort now, and we go from a heated house to a heated car to a heated office or whatever it is, we kind of lose that brown fat. And so I've been trying to put that on. I put on 20 to 30 pounds just to try to keep myself warm. That's really the only purpose of that. And I'm more nervous about the English Channel than probably any of the other events. It sounds funny. Everest is obviously a bit daunting and scary in some ways, but I think the English Channel is going to be a really big challenge for me.
That's going to be epic. And doing that, yeah, swimming for that long and being in that cold water is going to be a very interesting time. But you know, I'm sure just when you're in Everest, just climb it without a shirt on. That'd be some good acclimatization there.
Yeah, I think obviously we're going to be cold a good portion of the time there. So I'll have that. But I'll just need to get my swimming fitness back when I get home. And then after the English Channel, actually before the ride across America, Caroline and I are getting married. So when we were on the top of Cho Yu, she actually dropped to one knee and proposed to me. So in the middle of all this training for the Ultimate World Try, we've also got a plan for a wedding. So we're going to do that in August. And then in September, I'm going to ride across the country. I'm still dialing in the route, but basically from Seattle to Nantucket. And I'm going to do that. I believe I'm going to do that self-supported, just some panniers, and just kind of go for it and take about a month to do it. So I'm not trying to set any records or anything like that. I'm probably going to do about 100 to 125 miles a day and take about a month to go across the country.
Wow, you'll probably be going right by my house if you're going to Nantucket then. I'm right along the mess on 90 there, Route 90 that goes from Seattle to Boston. So
yeah, that would be great. We should meet up then.
Going there. Yeah.
I mean, I'm certainly, and whether it's you or anybody on the podcast listening, I'm looking for people to, you know, join for a day or two or whatever, because I think it'd be great to have some company and just make my way across the country.
And then you're going to go to Nantucket and sleep for like a month.
Yep. So I have a friend here in Park City who has, his folks have a house out in Nantucket, and he's always been trying to get me to go out there. And no offense to people who live in Nantucket, I've never been there, so I can't really speak to it. But I always kind of thought, yeah, it kind of sounds a little bit boring, but I should just ride my bike from Park City. And then maybe once I get there, I'll be like tired enough to just relax and just chill out and enjoy the beach and everything else. And so when I was looking for a final destination, it was easy choice. And I spoke to my friend, and we're going to end at his house there in Nantucket.
You have to swim instead of take the ferry across, though.
I considered that actually. And I really did. And I thought, well, gosh, if for some reason the English Channel doesn't work out, maybe I don't make it, or maybe the weather doesn't allow or something like that, I could try to swim to the island. But from what I can tell, people have swum from Nantucket to the mainland, but only one person has ever gone the opposite direction, because you're going against the waves and the tides. But it's still in the back of my mind. Don't worry.
Well, and you might get eaten by sharks too. You're going to need a shark tank on that. That's one. Cool. That one, it's crazy. The sharks down there now, it's unreal.
Okay. Well, I'll just scratch it off my list now then. That's one of the beauties about the English Channel, is that I will have some jellyfish, and it's the heaviest shipping lane in the world. So you've got a boat pilot is what they call them, to navigate you across.
Yep.
You can't touch the boat or anything like that, or otherwise you're DQ'd. But the one thing they don't have there is sharks. So that's a nice thing. So I don't have to worry about that.
Yeah. The shark world off Cape Cod right now is unbelievable, because there are so many seals there. Right. So that's where they come and they feed, and it's become sort of crazy of, you know, it's like shark week here all the time. There's actually a Nantucket beer company, Cisco Brewers, has a beer called Shark Tracker, and each can, you know, tracks a different shark, right? So you can actually see where the different sharks are based on the QC code that's on the can. So pretty interesting.
Well, I'm glad we have this talk so that I can just go ahead and scratch that swim off.
It's nuts. It's, you know, one of those things now that, you know, they're doing it from helicopters and taking a look at everything. Yeah. But, you know, we're coming up on a half hour here, guys. And what, you know, where can people find you? Where can they follow you? I think, you know, I'm super psyched to follow the both of you.
Yeah, I think the best way is just on social media. So on Instagram, my handle is rob.lea, and Lea is spelled L-E-A. And then Caroline's is just Caroline Gleick, and we're both on Facebook as well. Caroline's going to be doing a newsletter that, I don't know how often are you going to publish that?
Weekly. We're going to try to do a weekly newsletter. So there's a link to sign up for that in my Instagram and on Facebook and on Twitter.
Perfect. And I'll sign up for it too. And I'll try to post it along the way as well, because that is super exciting. And you know, your mission and what you guys are doing is super cool. And I probably want to wish you, you know, some amazing luck. And it was great to have you guys on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks for having us. And I don't know if we talked about it quite enough, but just want to remind people to try to support women in their life, whether it's, you know, climbing the nearest mountain or in their respective careers, but particularly women in leadership is what we want to talk about. And we want men to talk about this. It's not just a women's issue.
No, that is awesome. No, and like I said, I tried to preempt that at the beginning because I think that's a key. And given the confidence, like you were saying, Caroline, to kids to keep, you know, keep staying in sport and to keep going, because, you know, when you stop, it's over. And yeah, I think the importance of it is to just be starting at that point and staying active for the rest of your life.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And yeah, to be careful too. Like when women approach those different crossroads, like motherhood, don't just assume that they're going to like retire from mountaineering or from sports or from their work. I think just to give women more choices, that's sort of what we want to instill. So anyway, yeah, that's our spiel there. And we actually have a whole social media toolkit that has some, that has that bias disruptor worksheet. And that is also available on my Instagram in the highlights underneath my profile.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah. So awesome. Again, good luck on your trip. That sounds epic. Wish we could be there, but we'll be watching from afar. And if anyone has any questions, comments, or feedback, feel free to email me at ken@executiveathletes.com or reach out to either Caroline or Rob and their social media world. So keep on trucking this week, and success to everyone.